This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we talk to the U.S. representative and importer for Shark Aero and learn what it takes to import an airplane into the country. In the news, the House Aviation Subcommittee is holding hearings in advance of FAA reauthorization. A town targets a membership airline. A new online aviation video service launches. Travel bookings to the U.S. slow down, and the former chairman of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey is sentenced. Plus, we have a great memorable flight from a listener, actually two memorable flights, and we hear from some old friends down under. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 442 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and a glass cockpit expert. Max West, how are you?
Hey, I'm awesome, and I just want to say hello to you, our co-host, and listeners around the world. And I was listening to that part where you said glass cockpit expert, and I was thinking, so why then was I washing windows and cleaning gutters today? I mean, clearly I'm not doing what I was meant to be doing.
Sometimes you need those little diversions just to take care of the necessities of life, I guess.
You know what? It was nice being outside. It's kind of fun.
It's always nice being outside.
Yep.
Also joining us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and man about military aviation. David, it's been a while.
Hi, this isn't the UAV Digest. Am I on the wrong show?
It's Monday night.
Oh, that's right. I actually do this show occasionally. My apologies to all of our listeners. I know I've been on sporadically, but there's some challenges in my life currently, namely my father. So I drove very, very fast to be on here because I knew you guys missed me. So thanks for all the support everyone's been giving me. And I'm looking forward to talking tonight and doing a show.
Great. It's great to have you back, David. Brian Coleman is, he's on a business trip somewhere, has some kind of an event tonight. And Rob Mark is down at Heli Expo. So they're both off this episode. We do have a guest. Our guest is Jonathan Barron. He goes by JB. He owns the first and only Shark UL in the Americas, and he's also the representative and importer for Shark Aero. That's manufactured by Shark Aero SRO. It's type certified in Germany and the Czech Republic as an ultralight aircraft, but it's too fast and too complex to be a light sport aircraft here in the U.S., so the Shark UL is offered here as the Shark US, an experimental amateur-built kit with builder education and assistance. Now, JB himself is recently retired from the Navy after two decades as a naval aviator flying Seahawks. He's flown from every class of U.S. Navy combatant, including frigates, destroyers, cruisers, and aircraft carriers. In the Navy, JB was a fleet replacement instructor pilot, a weapons and tactics instructor, and the commanding officer of the West Coast Seahawk Weapons School. He holds a commercial airplane and helicopter pilot rating. He's an avid first-person video aeromodeler, and he's currently working as a lead systems engineer in the Washington, D.C. area. JB, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Now, one of the things we want to talk with JB about is what does it take to bring an aircraft into the United States? And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that. JB, your military career, though, in the Navy, a fleet replacement instructor pilot, what is that about?
So basically, you know, in the Navy, all the flying eventually turns into training, right? So basically, after your first fleet tour as a junior officer, they pick a couple of us to basically teach the new students how to fly the Seahawk. And, you know, it's the same as well for, you know, the Hornets, the Prowlers, the Growlers. So basically after your first tour, you go to another squadron where all they do is teach new, what they call them, fleet replacement pilots, how to fly the new aircraft. So this is usually after they've already gone through their primary flight training. So they're already winged. So we teach them how to fly their specific airplane.
What is the male-female ratio look like these days in the Navy for these kinds of pilots?
Yeah, so actually, you know, in the community that I was in, which is the helicopter community, it's a little bit better. It's about 20%, I think, between 15 and 20%, depending on who you ask.
Hmm.
And I think that's the goal throughout the fleet.
All right, we're going to have some interesting conversations coming up with JB. First, though, Max T, we still have our survey open, do we, on ATC privatization?
Yes, we do. We've got about 65 respondents. We'd love to see more. In particular, we would like to see more people from outside the U.S. who can share some of their experiences with privatization of ATC in their countries. So not only do we want to hear from everybody about how they feel about privatization, but if you're outside the U.S., tell us what the impact has been in your country. So you can find the survey at airplanegeeks.com/ATC.
Very good. All right, let's jump right into the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
First story comes from, well, Department of Transportation. This is Aviation Subcommittee to examine the state of the air transportation industry in the 21st century. Well, coming up later this year, we're going to see an FAA reform and reauthorization bill. At least that's the plan. So the House Aviation Committee is holding a number of hearings on the current state of the U.S. air transportation industry. Now, this upcoming hearing is titled Building a 21st Century Infrastructure for America, Air Transportation in the United States in the 21st Century, which sounds a little bit redundant to me. Don't you think, Max T?
Well, I guess I've learned over the years that any of the titles that you see come out of Washington never really quite say what they're about, so no surprise.
So what we have is this hearing is on Wednesday, March 8th. So that's also the day that we publish this episode. The hearing is 10 a.m. We'll put a link in the show notes. You can actually watch the live stream of the hearing if you don't get to it in time or it's after the hearing. You can still watch a video of the hearing. Who's testifying at this one? Well, let's see. We have the CEO of Alaska Air, the CEO of SkyWest, the CEO of Air Transport Services Group, the CEO of NetJets, the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, and the chairman of Travelers United. So it's kind of a, a restricted group of folks at this particular hearing. But it's not the first in this series. We'll put some links to the other hearings where you can watch them if you are so inclined. On March 1st, they had Building a 21st Century Infrastructure for America, State of American Airports. On February 15th was State of American Aviation Manufacturing. And then back in on February 1st, there was Building a 21st Century Infrastructure for America, sort of a general thing. So we'll have those in the show notes. It's an interesting process. The Subcommittee on Aviation has jurisdiction over pretty much all of civil aviation, safety, infrastructure, labor, commerce, and international issues. So this is the process of collecting testimony from witnesses who are involved in aviation or have some interest in it as the group prepares for the FAA reauthorization. I don't know. I haven't heard anything specific about where this committee is going, and I don't know if we're going to see ATC privatization come out of this or not.
Oh, I think almost certainly it's probably going to be inserted in this particular bill or something that supports it. For example, the basic med, the alternative to the third class medical we have this year, was a result of something that was inserted into last year's reauthorization bill. So it is that time of year where Congress takes the opportunity to kind of direct the FAA to do specific things. I don't know if they could direct them on ATC privatization or if that's going to have to be a separate bill itself. My guess is that'll be a separate bill, but that this will probably be highly supportive of that effort.
All right, let's jump into the next story. This is from AvWeb. Proposed San Carlos Airport ordinance targets Surf Air, excludes Ellison. This is about the residents of San Mateo County. They don't like the noise they hear from the Surf Air Pilatus PC-12s.
Oh, how could that be bad?
I know, David, the sound of the PC-12s is so wonderful, isn't it?
I like PC-12s, not as much as the Piaggios, but PC-12s, I guess any PT-6 sounds good. I'm sorry that those people moved in after there was an airport built.
Max T, what's going on here?
Well, to be fair, it's more like this particular airline, moved in recently. Now, we had CEO of Surf Air, Jeff Potter, on the show last year, and we talked about Surf Air, a membership airline, which has grown very rapidly. I just was on their website the other day, just by coincidence, and it said they now have 12 destinations here throughout California. And San Carlos has really been their headquarters pretty much, so a lot of flights go in and out, in and out, in and out. San Carlos is a small, roughly 2,800 foot runway, mostly smaller aircraft. So these are probably the biggest, noisiest things that come in and come out. What's really interesting about this is this proposed curfew ordinance was drafted in a way that really made it look like they were targeting Surf Air in particular. And when AvWeb, which had the story a couple of days ago, called the county to find out about it, whoever answered the phone said, yeah, we think it probably was, written to try and target them specifically. I think that's what always happens with these things. You go to court and they go, yeah, but somebody said the reason you did this was, not the reason you say you did it. So this might not hold up in court. It was written in a way that Larry Ellison, who is one of the richest men in America, CEO of Oracle Corporation, which is located a mile from this airport, he can fly his jet in and out. In fact, any jets are allowed, but noisy aircraft like the PC-12 are not. So it does look like they were really targeting Surf Air in particular. So my guess is that Jeff Potter and his crew will be working to try and find a way around this.
JB, what's the noise level like on the Shark? What kind of an engine does that use?
It's got a Rotax 912 ULS, and it's tiny. So most of the noise is in the propeller, really. So it's not much.
So likely the residents of San Mateo wouldn't be complaining about something powered by that engine.
No, I don't think so.
All right. Next item from Flying Mag. This is kind of interesting. We don't know too much about this yet. UFly TV launches an online aviation video network. This comes from Tom Poberesny and Jim Irwin. Now, if those names sound familiar, Poberesny particularly was the EAA Air Venture chairman from 1977 to 2011, and he was president of the EAA from 1989 to 2010. Jim Irwin is president of Aircraft Specialty and Spruce. So UFly TV it's aviation TV, basically. It's got a number of videos, 220 titles right now, they say, covering a variety of different aviation topics, and they're offering this up as a subscription service. So it's something to check out. It's at uflytv.com, like the letter U, F-L-Y, TV. Interesting. Good aviation video is always exciting to see. What do you guys think about this?
Yeah, I think we all were disappointed when the Wings Channel disappeared from cable. This may be kind of a modern day version of this, since it streams on the internet rather than being on cable. So, yeah, I hope they're successful. It should be fun.
They say that the titles that they offer, it covers pretty much everything: warbirds, interviews with aviation icons, they say, or World War II pilots, antique and aerobatic aircraft. There's no commercials, But it is a subscription service, at least as they're opening this up. So YouFly TV.
You know, that's interesting how that's working out, because in the radio control, the aviation world, that's been a, you know, a long standing MO for media producers, is to do live podcasts. I mean, as you know, and live video channels on YouTube. So I guess that's a different change. And for that matter, most of the younger viewers are on YouTube or online, as opposed to, you know, on cable these days.
Yeah, sure. I guess one question is, you know, will a paid subscription model and advertising free work, or are people kind of used to free content, and might that represent kind of a challenge? Other people have tried subscription aviation content of, you know, one sort or another online, and some are successful, some have a lot of difficulties staying in business, but hopefully this is something that has some, you know, staying power. I guess in large part, it depends on sort of the quality of the content.
Well, and also the price. 12 months, basically $50, 6 months, $28, 1 month, $6. So, you know, I guess people can kind of decide, you know, is that, you know, what they'd be willing to pay to have access to all this great video.
One of the issues with, you know, these kinds of services is they add up. We just added Hulu to our, you know, lineup of monthly subscriptions. We've already got Netflix. I'm not sure if we're going to keep Netflix and Hulu. And, of course, there's the cable charges and Showtime and HBO and all. They just keep adding up to more and more and more a month. So it's kind of a tough space to compete in. But certainly the people behind this have enough real aviation experience to know, I think, what kinds of content are going to appeal to av geeks. So that's good. Moving on to the New York Times. Trump uncertainty slowing U.S. travel bookings, according to a report. What's going on here?
So the I believe the original source on this was Reuters. Yes, it is. I found it on Reuters, and then the New York Times reprinted it. Basically, there is a company called Forward Keys, and they have done an analysis of 16 million flight reservations over the last 4 to 6 weeks to see what is the impact of the travel ban that the current administration has imposed on the seven countries in the Middle East. And I guess just today they announced that the new version of that ban is six countries. Iraq has been dropped from that list. But it's kind of interesting to kind of sort through the data. The overall net bookings on airlines for travel to the United States are about down about 3%. So that's pretty significant. And that's based on, I guess, things prior to the announcement of the initial travel ban. Business was running about 3.4 points ahead of where they were last year. Afterwards, it's dropped down to just 0.4 points. So, it, you know, the net drop of about three. Hmm. And then the biggest change, as you might expect, would be U.S. bookings from the Middle East. And that has that was running ahead 12% compared to last year. And I believe if I got my numbers right that it's down, I have to look it up here. I believe it's down 27%. So that is a huge drop. One airline executive here in the U.S. had said, well, it hasn't really infected us that much. And I guess that's probably because so much of their business is domestic and the international travel is a small portion of it. And also, I think that a lot of the Middle East travel ends up on overseas carriers like Emirates and Qatar. So that may be why the U.S. airlines are not, you know, feeling the pinch quite as much. But still, 3% decrease, pretty significant. You'd have to think that ultimately this is going to start hitting the bottom lines of some of these airlines.
Sure, the airlines and the travel industry in general, I would think, you know, hotel bookings and, you know, all that goes along with tourism and that sort of thing.
Travel insurance, but you didn't hear it from me.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Good point.
Yeah, it's really fascinating how these things kind of percolate through the economy, you know, and there's sort of a multiplying effect. But it's not surprising to me anyway that tourism, especially from the Middle East, is down or passengers coming from the Middle East. I guess whether it's tourism or business travel, kind of expect that to go down in this climate that we're in right now.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of second-order effects, things that are not intended when large-sweeping new things like this are implemented. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but I've come across two kind of unintended consequences just in the last week or so. The first was that a major aircraft manufacturer that's not based in the U.S. is looking at sourcing more of the materials outside the United States because of the uncertainty regarding whether or not there may be sanctions, and that may be difficult for them to export American avionics and components to put into their aircraft. So they're now looking for sources from other countries. So that could have an impact. And the other one was just a couple of days ago, I was flying with a gentleman who brought along one of his colleagues. Both of them are in executive MBA programs at Stanford, and one of them, both of them from outside the country, one from the Scandinavian countries and one from Asia. And one of them commented that it's maybe very difficult for them to get jobs after they graduate from their programs because companies may be very reluctant to hire new grads, not knowing if they'll be able to stay in the country.
Hmm.
Okay, that's depressing. Moving on.
Yeah, it is depressing. All right. Well, let's talk about somebody who maybe in the end got what they deserved, or at least to a certain extent. We had talked in the past about David Sampson. He was the chairman of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and he was charged with using his position back in 2012 to pressure American Airlines to revive a flight from Newark to Columbia, South Carolina, which happened to be about where his weekend home was. Well, he was charged with that, and we now see, I think, just today that he was sentenced for his activities there.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. He could have gotten up to 2 years for basically extorting United Airlines to put this flight onto their schedule for his convenience. By the way, it saved him about an hour of driving time when he got to his residence down there. And so rather than the full 2 years, they had argued that he was old and sick and might not be around that long. He is 77. He has been sentenced to home confinement for 1 year, I believe. Now, we should mention that this guy is a two strikes offender.
Oh, really?
Yep. This is the second time that this gentleman has been tangled up in things that were involved the Port Authority of New York. He was one of the people who was investigated and subsequently charged with things related to Bridgegate, the very interesting payback scheme where lanes coming out of a town from New Jersey into the George Washington Bridge were shut down for 4 days, largely as payback for the mayor of that town not supporting the reelection campaign of the governor of New Jersey. So I'm afraid that Mr. David Sampson probably wishes that he'd left the Port Authority a couple years before he did, because he's been caught up in court twice and convicted twice now. So hopefully he doesn't get a third strike. He may go away for life.
Yeah, what little of it perhaps is left. I guess that's not very charitable. But.
Yeah, no, I guess the key thing is, we all have decisions. We have those moments, and man, you really got to think long and hard about the long-term consequences of, some of these decisions. It's like, nah, take the high road.
Yes. All right. We saw an article in The Onion, American Airlines to phase out complimentary cabin pressurization. That's right. Apparently, the costs of pressurization have grown in recent years, and American Airlines announced that they're no longer going to offer that for free starting March 15th. They say, quote, "Unfortunately, to stay competitive as a legacy carrier in today's air travel market, it no longer makes economic sense for us to provide breathable air at altitude." And the article goes on.
I really love this. I mean, we've talked so many times on this program about where things are headed with the airlines. I don't think we'd ever thought of this one. I love this. While we regret any altitude sickness, blood problems, dim vision, or hyperventilation that may result from air pressure less than a third of normal levels, remind our customers that such effects will diminish as soon as the aircraft descends below 10,000 feet.
Oh, all right. Well, of course, The Onion is famous for just some really, really well done spoofs. Not so much, well, partly because they're just kind of clever, but also because they're really poignant. And this is another one of those, happens to be aviation related. It's hysterical. This is worth reading. It'll, you know, it'll make you smile. One more item, and just briefly on a serious note, March 8th is the three-year anniversary of the loss of MH370. It's been 3 years, kind of hard to believe.
Yeah, and I just saw an article a couple of days ago that said Malaysia Airlines is finally starting to bounce back. I mean, that really hit them very hard, not to mention, of course, the impact on all the families. And, you know, someday, hopefully, we'll know what happened.
Yeah, I hope so. I understand the families of the victims are undertaking some efforts to raise money in order to continue the search. So they're trying to fund that or to elicit donations to fund the continuation of the search. So, boy, it would just be so nice if we could find that aircraft and bring some closure to this.
Yeah, and hopefully this will be the last time that, you know, in the history where an aircraft is lost like this. I think new technology may solve this problem in the future.
I hope. Again, we're speaking with Jonathan Barron, JB, the U.S. representative and importer for Shark Aero. JB, I have to ask you, what caused you to decide to undertake a project like bringing a new aircraft into the United States?
You mean, what were you thinking?
Yeah. Did you just wake up one morning and say, hey, let's bring the Shark in?
Yeah, no, I didn't. Actually, my wife asked me that too, so fair question. She's awesome. She let me do it. But so as you said, you know, I spent 20 years in the Navy, you know, flying. Basically, the happiest I was ever flying was in a T-34 in flight school. And at first I wanted to buy a T-34, but then I realized, yeah, I was too poor for that and they tend to break a lot. So I just started surfing the internet and found this airplane. So once I decided I wanted this airplane, the process began. And then the process, actually, it turned out that I was the first one that owned one here, or that I would be the first one to own one here. And I wound up being the representative as well.
Well, what drew you to this airplane?
You know, it's a two-seater. Actually, the big thing is it doesn't cost much to operate. I mean, my take on it is I see a lot of people in the flight line and they have these awesome airplanes, but they're too poor to fly them on a regular basis. And in my opinion, that's a safety issue. You know, in the Navy, they teach you the more flight time that you have, and it's true, the safer you are. So that was primarily the first and foremost. It had to be reasonable, if not cheap, to operate. And, you know, at 5 gallons per hour of gasoline, we fly pretty regularly on a normal person's salary. So that's one. And then the next one is it had to be fun, right? So, I mean, what's the point of flying if it wasn't fun? So, again, I wanted something that was a tandem, a low-wing complex. You can throw it around the sky a little bit. And then finally, I wanted something that can go somewhere. And, you know, this airplane has 1,000-mile legs if you milked it. And of course, you know, the number one criteria from my wife is, I have to be safe. So, the airplane has all the safety features that, that make sense, right? And a bunch of things that you wouldn't think about. Like, you know, I think that having dual controls makes a big difference. And, you know, just because you can have two pilots, having the thing has a safety cage that basically doesn't, you know, it's designed not to crumple around the airplane. So the rest of the airplane is, though, and it has a parachute. So those are really the big things that that drew me to this airplane.
Is that the ballistic recovery parachute that we see in the Cirrus, for example?
Yes. Yeah. So this one is, it's not a BRS parachute. I forget the name of the manufacturer, but it's a European parachute, similar.
And where was the plane designed and built?
Yeah, so the airplane was designed by a gentleman named Jaro Dostal. He's a pretty prolific designer. He's based out of the Czech Republic. And the airplane is built in in Slovakia, just south of the Czech and Slovak border. And the developer, you know, CEO of Shark Aero is a gentleman named Vlado Pekar. And he's kind of the genius that basically brought the airplane, you know, from paper to reality. So, yeah, it's built in Slovakia. And, you know, it's got a Rotax out of Austria, and it's got avionics. Mine has Dynons here out of America, so it's a pretty international airplane.
Is there any connection between the designers of this aircraft and the people that designed the Sport Cruiser, which I think comes out of the Czech Republic? I just look at the lines on these aircraft, and you know, there's just some similarities that just kind of make me think of that aircraft.
I'm not sure. I know Jaro designed a couple other airplanes, but you know, his trademark is the ventral fin, which actually in this airplane turned out making it look like a shark, you know, thus the name.
Mm.
Yep. But you know, that part of the world is a hotbed for light airplanes.
Yes, yes.
And I think a lot of it is because of the you know, the leftover knowledge from you know, the Soviet era. I'm not sure, but that's my guess.
And yeah,
you also have the you know, the engine manufacturer close by, Rotax. So that kind of drives that part of the world is a hotbed for light sport airplanes.
Yeah, that dates back to actually World War II. I remember we had someone on here a while ago talking about the birth of the Israeli Air Force right after World War II, and they were shipping planes from, I believe it was Czechoslovakia, so I don't recall which part of the country, down to Israel. So, you know, they've had manufacturing going on there for a long time. Now, did you build this yourself, or did you bring it in as a completed aircraft?
I brought it in as a completed aircraft, so that actually changed the process a little bit, but... Yeah, you know, here in the U.S., if you bought it here in the U.S., then it would be an experimental amateur built kit, because, like, as you said earlier, it's too fast to be a LSA, and yeah, too complex to be an LSA as well.
So, what was the first step when you decided that this was the airplane you wanted? How did you go about learning what the process was to get it here?
Actually, you know, so there are a bunch of different players that you have to satisfy for the airplane to come across the pond, right? Hmm. So first and foremost, you have to make the FAA happy, right? Because if they're not going to let you fly it, then, you know, why bother bringing it in? So you have to check the FAA box. And essentially what you're trying to do is sort out what kind of airworthiness certificate that you'd be eligible for. So you could either, you know, normally you would get a, you know, some people would just buy a type certificated airplane. That's a no-brainer. But, you know, in my case, it had to be an experimental because there was no real category in the U.S., so since I bought a ready-to-fly airplane, the only category to be certificate is an experimental exhibition airworthiness certificate. And that has some operating limits, which actually turn out to be not so onerous. An experimental amateur built, which is what is typical, you essentially have to bring it in a kit form, and the owner manufacturer puts together, and he's responsible for 51% of constructing the airplane. So in my case, since I bought a ready to fly airplane, like I said, it fell under the experimental exhibition category. And I can go into that if you're interested.
Yeah. I guess I'm curious, primarily, is that a purely a paperwork process, you know, where, you know, you submit, I don't know what, to the FAA, and they, you know, they look at the paper and then approve it or not? How does that work?
Oh, so basically, by the time you get to the FAA, that's later, right? You just first, you know, so, okay, you decide on this airplane, and then you talk to the FAA and you consult them and say, okay, what airworthiness certificate would I be eligible for? And in my case, I'd already done the homework, and it was an EE. So, and then from there, but when it gets to the U.S., an inspector actually takes a look at it and make sure it is in fact airworthy. And that's usually done by a representative from the FAA, you know, from the FISDO, or a lot of people just go with a designated airworthiness representative, which is basically a private contractor
right. That's
certified by the FAA to make those calls. Right. So it's both a paperwork drill and there's a physical inspection associated with it. And, you know, before you get to that point, then you're checking a bunch of boxes where the FAA is kind of asking you, well, you know, do you have a magnetic compass? You know, is it marked properly? And, you know, and then they take a look at it and make sure that everything you said was true is true. And then they give you the airworthiness certificate. But there's a lot of things that needs to happen before you get to that point. And not the least of which is the airplane physically showing up in the United States.
It sounds like there's some risk, right? You bring the airplane over here and then you're going through this process. The conclusion of the process isn't completely certain, right?
No, but you know, you can do your homework so that it's, you know, it's nearly certain. That's why it took a while. It took me from the time that we bought the airplane till the time that we flew it was almost 9 months.
Hmm.
So And then, you know, before we bought the airplane, there was probably 6 to 8 months worth of research. It's complicated, but it's not impossible. I mean, I managed to do it. But, you know, there's definitely a lot of boxes you have to tick.
So what are some of those other things that have to happen before this is all said and done?
You decide on the airplane, the type, and then as soon as you pick a specific one, then you have to make sure that the thing's actually airworthy, right? So that, you know, that requires, you know, some people, again, hire a DAR to inspect the airplane, or, you know, another inspection professional, right? I decided I was good enough to do it. I haven't been a maintenance officer in the Navy for a while. You have to look at the, you know, check things like physical appearance, maintenance records, and kind of study the aircraft's history. Right? So once you decide that it's, you know, actually airworthy, then you close the deal and pay for it, and, you know, you change ownership, right? And that's, you know, that's in some places that's pretty straightforward. In some places it is not. So once you paid for it, of course, after you've determined that it's airworthy, now you have to get transition training, right? Because the next wicket that you have to basically get through is getting insurance, right? Because if your airplane winds up being uninsurable, then
that's going to be a problem.
That's a problem, right? And it turns out that, you know, one of the biggest variables in insurability is pilot proficiency or pilot qualifications, right? So being that the airplane was, there was no other place to get training on that airplane here in the U.S. I had to go to a factory rep or a factory trained instructor pilot to get that training. And, you know, when I asked for, you know, my insurance provider basically specified that I had to do at least 6 hours of transition training. And I think they vary that depending on what your personal experience is, but they told me to do 6 hours, and I wound up doing, I think, 10 hours just because it was awesome. Yeah. So that's the next wicket. You have to get transition training. Now, I will say, I'd like to put a plug in. I did my transition training in this little airport in Italy called in Tiene in Italy. It's about an hour's drive from Venice. And it was in a flight school that was run by the father-son team, right? The father was a starfighter pilot. You know, he was an airline pilot after that. And Simone, the dude that taught me to fly the Shark, was he was an aerobatics, European aerobatics champion. So they run this little flight school in this little grass airstrip that does gliders, balloons, helicopters. You know, they have a Cirrus, they have a couple of helicopters, they also build their own simulators. I mean, the place just lives and breathes aviation, right? There's a nice little Italian restaurant there. You know, they've got a little playground for kids. I mean, it's just an awesome place to fly. You know, and people basically, you know, the first day I was there, it was like late spring. Yeah, it was late spring. The day started off with, I think, 30 gliders lined up, and they just launched and they would fly north to the Dolomites and spend the entire day there surfing the wind currents. It was awesome. And then, you know, at the end of the day, all these, you know, 20 or 30 air gliders would come back, and just like the Marshall stack on an aircraft carrier is really, really impressive. You know, so they had that going on. They had lots of LSA flying going on. It was just great. You know, like, you know, when we would get on the airplane in the morning, fly a sortie, come back, go to the trattoria and get coffee and lunch, and then get back in the airplane again and fly again. And I'll never forget. I think I may have sent you a video. There's a video where we went to this this airport. It's the highest airport in Italy. It was about 3,000 AGL. It's called Asiago, right? And so we launched from it, and you're in the valleys of the mountains and just picking your way through it. It was awesome. So by the way, I learned how to fly the airplane off the lagoon off of Venice. You know, flying within sight of St. Mark's Square. So that was pretty awesome too. So yeah. So if you're ever in Northern Italy, in Venice, take the hour drive to Tiene and see those guys. It's awesome.
Boy, this sounds like way more fun than I was expecting to hear. This is quite an experience.
Yeah, it was a hoot. So I went there twice actually, because the first time I got rained out, and then the second time, it was awesome.
So now you've got your transition training. So what happens next?
So now, you know, so the thing's got to go in a box, right? So I was fortunate that my airplane actually was designed to do that. So, you know, the wings come off with four big bolts, and then it's a couple little bolts here and there, but it's meant to come off and be in a box within 30 minutes. And sure enough, it did, right? It's pretty awesome. So at the end of my transition training, they pulled the wings off the airplane, and we wrapped it in bubble wrap. We drained it, obviously, of the fluids, and then we stuck it in the box, and then I went home. And a couple of weeks later, things showed up here in Virginia.
It goes by ship, I would imagine.
Yep, it does. So, and that's actually really interesting. So when we moved it, we couldn't believe that there's actually no import duties for aviation, at least that size airplane. Did you know that?
No, interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's because we try to promote reciprocity, right? We sell out our airplanes out in the real world, right? So, if, you know, we basically would, you know, it wouldn't be good for us if they tariffed our airplanes. So reciprocally, I think that's why that's the case. I mean, we checked it and it was like, wow, that's cool. There's no import duty for airplanes.
So the customs process went pretty smoothly, it sounds.
Yeah, but you know, that requires it's not like the mail, right? Like there are bonds that you have to put up just in case things go wrong. Somebody has to handle the airplane in and out of the port. All those things, but you know, there are professionals that take care of that. That was really astounding to us that there's no tariffs on it. Pretty awesome. So, you know, so it shows up in the US, it gets shipped to, you know, to our airport. Then, you know, you have to get it out of the box, right? And that was a challenge in itself. We basically wound up using a flatbed tow truck. Hmm. So have you ever seen that process?
Not for a box that big.
So you don't actually take it out of the box. You just roll the airplane on the flatbed, incline it, and then roll the plane on the ground. So, you know, amazingly, and where did I learn to do that? On YouTube. There's a lot of stuff on YouTube.
Oh, that's amazing. YouTube. Yeah. YouTube. And what did the plane come out of the box undamaged?
Yeah. So what they do is they strap, so the airplane has tie down points. So you basically, you know, tie down like you're tying it down in a hangar, like in a Navy hangar. So the thing doesn't move in ship. So then came out and we put it together and then we had to wait for the FAA to go take a look at it. So the next process, by the way, once it's here, is to register it. Right, and that's another astounding thing. You know how much it costs to register an airplane? $5.
$5. Wow.
It's the same as registration for a drone.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Okay, sure.
Yeah, it's $5, but I splurged. I spent the extra $12 to get my N number.
Oh, custom number that had some meaning to you. What did you choose?
So it's a N235 Hotel Kilo, so it's number 23 Shark.
Beautiful.
Because the airplane is the 23rd plane off the assembly line.
Very nice.
Got it.
Yep.
So the
yep.
5 looks like the S, so Shark, S-H-K.
Yeah.
Got it.
So, yeah, so you register it. And then, of course, I'm in Virginia, so I had to go pay Virginia airplane taxes. So that kind of bites a little bit. But we're still pretty amazed at how easily that went. So now it's in the U.S. It's registered, right? And you have to – only when it's registered will you be eligible for an airworthiness certificate, right? Mm-hmm. So, by the way, before that, you have to get insurance. So I think we already addressed a little bit of it. The first thing that they look at is, so the factors that go into your airplane's insurance is your experience as a pilot and how much it costs to replace the hull. So if you ball up the airplane, how much would it cost them to replace it? And so those are the two primary drivers of how much insurance costs. Yeah, it was expensive, but as one of my friends put it, it's like having a car with a teenager.
And besides, after spending zero on YouTube videos and $5 to register it, you know, what's a few more dollars, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, that's probably the biggest expense. You know, so the biggest expense for me right now is the insurance and the hangar of costs. But, you know, that's pretty reasonable.
Okay.
So now that you have insurance, we basically had to, you know, so I could have either hired a DAR who would show up within a week or so. But then, you know, I'm pretty cheap. So I waited for the FAA to be available. And I waited, you know, that was free, getting an airworthiness certificate from the FAA, which is pretty awesome. You just have to wait, right? And since it's just a toy, it's not a revenue-producing device. Well, at least not yet. It was worth it for us to wait. So, you know, in the process of doing that, you know, you establish rapport with the inspector. He tells you what he's looking for. You make sure it's all in accordance. And then, you know, once he says you're ready and he's ready, he shows up and takes a look at the airplane, all the records, and you know, that it's appropriately, yeah, Americanized, right? So, for example, my airplane was European, so all the markings were in liters and kilometers per hour. So I had to make sure that, you know, they were all in gallons and knots or miles per hour. I chose knots. And then, yeah, you know, since all the markings were, you know, in a Dynon, so it was just basically a menu selection. By the way, Dynons are awesome. And I know you guys had the Dynon president last. I mean, that's really an awesome product. And I would say that it's pretty sophisticated. It's, you know, a lot of the stuff on my Dynon was more sophisticated than the stuff I had in my helicopter in the Navy. So, yep, thumbs up for Dynon. But, yeah, so actually what's interesting is one of the markings that I had to, the inspector had to go around twice because I had to mark the airplane appropriately for if I was in a crash, how would somebody know to open the airplane?
Sure, that makes sense.
Yeah, so I, you know, that delayed us about a week. So I had to get stickers made so that I can stick it on the side of the airplane to tell them to reach into the window to unlatch the canopy to get me out. So, yeah, it's pretty straightforward. And then from there, you know, you get the airworthiness certificate that gives you the FAA's permission to fly, tells you the airplane is safe. And then, oh, by the way, one of the biggest wickets for the FAA to give you an airworthiness certificate is to do a 100-hour inspection on the airplane, right, which is, you know, a normal annual, right?
Okay.
And, yeah, so that basically identifies things that could be wrong or, and, you know, that require correction so that when they bless it, then it's, you know, they know at a reasonable level that it's in good shape. So that was, you know, that was another thing we had to go through before I get the airworthiness certificate. But, you know, once that was all said and done, as soon as he handed you the green or the pink paper, then you could take the airplane out flying. But, yeah, before that, you know, we had to do the first flight that we had to do. I followed the functional check flight and the acceptance procedure that you would get from the factory if you had delivered it. That's what I wound up doing before actually taking passengers flying with the airplane. But yeah, I think, and then so after the pink sheet was signed, we had to fly off 10 hours in the vicinity of our local airport before we could freely fly the airplane. So once all that was said and done, we were off flying that airplane. And we managed to complete all that in November, and it's now, I've flown about 30 plus hours on it, 32 hours, and it's a hoot. Yeah, we fly it every weekend when we can. Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, like mine was definitely the hard way. The easy way is, you know, if you got a TC'd airplane, it's fairly straightforward.
Are you a dealer for these now?
I'm really the rep out here and the importer, so I guess I am.
Okay.
You know, it's a small factory, so there's not really it's a small factory and it's a small volume airplane, so there's not really much of a.
They don't have a direct sales force.
Yeah. You know, the demand just can't support it just yet. So
that's typical for any small company in any industry. Start out with reps, and then as you get bigger, you get, you know, people on the salary.
And, you know, one of the things that the company is really big at is, you know, financial solvency, right? A big strategy is, you know, you leverage debt and things like that. So we, you know, the company basically is building off of what they earn, right? So it's a little bit slower, but I think it'll be better for the consumer in general.
So JB, tell us a little bit more about some of the performance specs. You've mentioned a couple of things, but fill us out a little bit on the performance of the Shark.
Yeah, so, you know, the Shark is per the FAI. I don't know what, you know, I don't know how you say that. It's the Federation Aviation Internationale, right, which is the governing body for aviation records. It's the fastest ultralight in the world, right? But, you know, ultralight is very variable. Essentially, it's the fastest airplane flown on a Rotax 100 horsepower engine. And I think the record is a little bit over 300 kilometers per hour. I can't remember the exact number, but you know, that's what's officially on record. But, you know, there's a gentleman in Norway, he owns an engine tuning company, Edge Performance, and his Shark, instead of being powered by 100 horsepower Rotax, it's powered by 160 horsepower turbocharged Rotax, right? So he's doing 200 knots You know, the fastest he's taken it recently was almost 200 knots, but he stopped at that speed because it was getting, you know, it was kind of bumpy. He didn't want to push it, but he had a little bit more to go. But think about that, 200 knots, that's almost 400 kilometers per hour.
Yeah, it's amazing when you figure a Cessna 172 is, at least the new ones are 160 horsepower. Well, not the newest ones. Newest are 180. But anyway, comparable to that, and you're looking at maybe 120 knots. So big difference.
Yeah, and, you know, like I said, my airplane's a just a simple 100 horsepower airplane. And, you know, I cruise 150 knots.
So you've got the one and only of these in the United States at this point. If someone else is interested in bringing one of these in, they're not going to have to go through the same process that you did, certainly. You were the trailblazer, I guess.
Yeah. So, you know, it's fairly, like I said, you know, once now that I know what I know, it's actually not so bad. And everybody's terrified of the FAA. So as long as you understand what they're looking for, it's actually fairly straightforward. And, you know, truth be told, the expense of bringing it out here wasn't that expensive. I mean, you know, you have to pay for the postage, so to speak. That was a couple of $1,000, but it's, you know, it's appropriate for what you're moving into the country. So essentially, you know, there are two ways of doing it. You can either do it my way and get an experimental exhibition airworthiness certificate where, you know, and that's if your FISDO will let you have it. A lot, you know, one of the things about the FAA is it all always depends, right? It all depends on how it's interpreted. But so that's one way. And then the other way is as an experimental amateur build kit, right? In which case, you know, that's actually what we're primarily selling in the U.S. It's a 51% kit, right? So essentially the kit shows up. It's, you know, the fuselage, which is already joined together, wings that are joined, but they're all not finished. And, you know, they're all the state that the airplane arrives in is such that, or I'm sorry, the kit arrives in such that you can do 51% of the work. And, you know, 51% is actually an interesting definition. The FAA has a checklist of tasks to build an airplane, right? And I forget what the total number is. I think there's 200 some odd tasks. And each one of those tasks is apportioned 0 to 1 in terms of, you know, so if you did all of the tasks, then it's 1. And if you did none of the tasks, it's 0 and somewhere in between. And you got to apportion those tasks between the manufacturer, somebody who helps you build it, and you, right? So what you do is at the end, you have to check out all those tasks. And at the end of it, you have to calculate that it's 51%.
Is that based on the number of tasks or is it, it's related to the amount of effort required for the tasks?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
Right? So, so for example, the cutting out the instrument panel is equivalent to finishing, you know, it's one check compared to finishing the skin of the airplane. One task is clearly more difficult than the other, but yet it's one task.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
But it's a checklist. It's in the, I wish I had, I'll send you a link to it. That's one way of doing it. It's showing up as an experimental amateur build. So one of the reasons why people go with EAB is because it's supposed to be less, the airworthiness certificate is less onerous, right? So in the experimental exhibition, airworthiness with it, you have to write what they call a program letter. So every year I have to tell the FAA what I'm going to use the airplane for, which for me is to demonstrate the airplane, right? Because I'm the representative here in the U.S.
Sure.
So I basically give them a list of all the air shows I'm going to. So, and it, you know, by date and, you know, how far and where I'm going to stop. And then there's an understood area around my home base where I can operate the airplane for proficiency purposes, right? Which actually is probably 90% of my flight time, right? Because when do I ever do cross countries? So yeah, you have to tell the FAA on an annual basis where you're going. And if you deviate from it, you just send them another letter saying, hey, I'm going to add this on, and it resets your clock for another year. And then you have to get an A&P to do the maintenance on your airplane. Right, which is fine by me and fine by my wife because, you know, again, an A&P is probably much better at maintaining an airplane than I would, right? But it's, you know, such a small airplane, it's, you know, it doesn't cost that much. Hmm. And then, so compare that to an EAB, which is essentially, you know, once you get it checked out by the FAA and you get your airworthiness certificate, you don't have to tell anybody what you do with it. You can basically fly it at will.
Well, JB, I'm kind of getting the impression that you don't regret having done any of this.
No, it's pretty awesome.
Tell us, who is this a good airplane for?
Yeah, so there's a lot of you know, there's a lot of people that like this airplane. I mean, it's probably good to note that it's a UL, it's an ultralight in Europe. And I say that because much like, you know, here in the U.S., the way the airplanes are designed, they're designed to meet specifications, right? And, you know, the UL design has a lot of weight restriction, right? Because the idea is the smaller the airplane, the less damage it would cause on the ground, right? It also has airspeed minima, right? So in other words, it has to land fairly slowly. Again, basically the idea is, you know, less experienced pilots, you know, it'd be better for them to have a slower stall speed or a slower landing speed. So, you know, so because of that, the airplane is actually designed very efficiently. It had to be very efficient, right? So who's the airplane for? It's for somebody that probably wants an LSA, you know, for all the reasons why somebody buys an LSA. But wants an airplane that goes faster, you know, where you can go somewhere. I mean, 120 knots is okay, right? But why not go 150 knots at 5 gallons per hour, which means you can go from, I always tell everybody, I can go from here in DC to Atlanta in about 3.5 hours or to Jacksonville for not much more than that on a tank of gas that's less than a pickup truck, right? I have a 27 gallon tank, right? And the airplane goes at 150 knots for about 5 gallons, maybe a little bit more per hour. And by the way, that's gasoline, so it costs less than 100 low lead. That's primarily who the airplane's for, is somebody who wants to get somewhere on the cheap in something that looks really cool and doesn't cost much to operate, which means you can fly it more often, which means you're safer in it, right? Another group of people that tend to like it are military pilots or ex-military pilots. And I think a lot of it is because the beta pilot was, or, you know, a lot of the beta pilots were former fighter pilots, right? And you could see it in the design of the airplane, you know, between the bubble canopy, the glass cockpit, the side stick, the parachute, even the parachute T-handles between the legs, just like in a...
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know, there's a pin that you got to pull out. So that's kind of cool. And then another population that we're looking at are folks that are downsizing from, say, a Cirrus or a Lancer. So basically this airplane, it's a little bit slower, but it'll go just as far and is a hell lot cheaper to operate. Who else? Younger pilots, you know, J3 Cubs are awesome, but my experience is kids that grew up on iPhones and Apples, they don't think they're cool anymore. So younger pilots, which, you know, we sorely need in the community. And again, if you have an airplane that doesn't operate, you know, it doesn't cost so much to operate, then you can get a lot more people in the airplane, a lot more when you get them in the airplane, a lot more touches in it. So that's all goodness there. And then finally, it's probably a good airplane for a flying club as well. You know, it's probably the closest thing you'll get to a complex airplane that goes fast, relatively fast anyway, that looks cool and operate on the cheap. And of course, there's always talk about, you know, selling it as part of as a military trainer. But that's, you know, that you have to find the right market for that.
Wow. Just amazing. And besides all that, it just looks great. I just thought, the first time I saw a photo of this, the lines it just flows. And Shark is definitely the right name for it.
Yeah, I think, you know, so that airplane was, you know, was designed to be as small as possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was designed to basically occupy the least amount of space in the to have what they call wetted surface, right? You don't want to have as much of, you want to minimize the size of the surface area that the wind flies through so that it can go fast, right? So that airplane is basically as small as it can get and still fit two people comfortably and the gas and the engine to go fast. So that's what actually drove the shape. And, you know, the pointy shark fin, I think that was the only compromise in design to the marketing guys.
Well, I think it was worthwhile, a worthwhile compromise. Well, JB, where do folks go to learn more about the Shark?
Yeah, so we have a website. It's sharkaero.com. And I'm also on Facebook at facebook.com/sharkaerousa. And you can reach me at john@sharkaero.com.
And that's John spelled?
J-O-N.
Great. All right, JB, thanks so much. Appreciate it. This is a really interesting story. I'm kind of a little surprised that the process went as almost as smoothly as it sounds like it did, although it took a significant period of time to accomplish. So, but it's really interesting to learn about how you can do this process. Max T, have you run across anybody else ever that's imported an airplane?
Boy, not that I can recall off the top of my head, but is this a good time to announce to our listeners the giveaway that we're planning for one of these?
Oh, are we having a giveaway?
This is really an awesome looking airplane, great performance numbers. So yeah, I'm very excited about it.
I was going to suggest that he show up with it at Be a Pilot Day in June at the Smithsonian.
Yeah, yeah. I had the same thought, David. Yeah, JB, you should talk to the Smithsonian folks, see if you can be part of the fly-in.
Yeah, yeah. So I've already talked to them. I've sent the request over. Hopefully they'll accept it.
Yeah, well, I do too.
I'll put a good word with Margie.
This would fit right in because this is such a unique aircraft, and that represents a good opportunity to join in the fly-in. All right, good. So, JB, again, thanks for joining us on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on. And if you're anywhere in the DC area, let me know. We'll go flying.
All right, one quick shout-out that we wanted to make. Max T, you and I, well, okay, I'll be honest. You and Drone Mama both ran across this topic, this article today, and encouraged us to include it, and I'm glad you guys found it. This is an article from CNN, Air India's all-female crew makes history with round-the-world flight.
Yeah, I saw this this morning as a retweet from the San Francisco International Airport. And at first I thought, well, wait a minute, they just flew from Delhi to San Francisco. But as I read more, they flew across the Pacific to get to San Francisco. They, you know, rested for a day or whatever it was. And then the same all-female crew continued on eastward across the Atlantic back to Delhi. So they did indeed go all the way around the world. And everybody associated with the flight was female. So that included, you know, the mechanics, the dispatchers, all the ground staff, the entire flight crew. Really fantastic. And there are a number of great photos. So if you go out to any of the links like this one at CNN, you can see them celebrating at San Francisco and when they got back to Delhi as well. Very cool.
Are we going to have to cover this on Thursday night because it was an unmanned aircraft?
Oh, that's good.
Oh, very good, David. Very good. Maybe we should. Yeah, put it in the show plan, David. All right. And Max T, you had an appearance in your area, what, on the local NBC affiliate?
Yes, I was interviewed last week. And, you know, the sad thing is whenever one is on the news, it's usually about something that's not, you know, good. And I was interviewed last week about the Cessna 310 crash in Riverside, California last week. That flight was from the Bay Area, so that was the connection. And unfortunately, it crashed on the takeoff on Riverside as they were returning back to San Jose International Airport. So I've been on NBC's local affiliate before talking about various topics. And I was actually in the aircraft when they texted me and said, gosh, too bad you're not available for an interview. And I said, well, I land at 5 o'clock, and they said, fine, we'll be at the Palo Alto Airport at 5:15. So gave a brief interview, and as you probably know, for most of these things, yeah, they record a fair amount of stuff, and then they take, you know, 20 seconds.
Right, yeah.
I mean, that's an exaggeration, but
pretty they close, did
take,
though.
Yeah, they did take two small clips, and, you know, I participate in these kinds of things simply because I want to try and get the correct story out there. And I was really impressed when they were done with the story. I thought that it was, you know, they did a reasonable job of portraying the overall situation, which is great.
And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. You can watch Max T. All right, David, you made a little trip recently.
I did. You know, when my life gets miserable, I go to the Smithsonian. Saturday was, they did not have an open house this year in January because they were concerned about snow.
ironically, they decided to have an open house this weekend. And the weekend they normally had it, it was 70 degrees in January, and we had snow squalls and 18 degrees on Saturday in March. But the primary reason was Apollo was going on the move. The back of the house was opened up because the Apollo 11 command module, or what's left, lunar capsule Columbia, is going out on tour to various science museums over the next 2.5 years. So this was sort of a say goodbye to her. Two reasons. One, she's very famous. Number two is they are in the process of building an exhibit in the Air and Space Museum downtown. Originally, Columbia was located in the Milestones of Flight Gallery. And with the revamp of the Milestones of Flight Gallery, they have decided to put Columbia in her own exhibit, much like what they did with the Wright Flyer. The Wright Flyer also originally was in the Milestones of Flight Gallery. And it then, so there's a Journey to the Moon gallery that's being developed. And as they're building and that downtown, Columbia is going out to St. Louis and a couple of other cities for like 6 months stays. So it'll be about 2.5 years that it'll be on the road. So due to the crowds, I wasn't able to get an interview with the science staff. The wait to see Columbia was 2 hours.
Wow.
But it was a good day down at the Smithsonian. I got to see our friends, Vicky and Sarah and Nick. And all of them were like looking forward to seeing us in June at Be a Pilot's Day. That's already in the works. The expectation is we'll be there again. And so, and it was, you know, my opinion on the rarefied air at the Smithsonian. I was climbing stairs and moving up and down and doing things I haven't really done a lot of. So it was a good day overall. And I did get an interview with one of the restorers of currently the big restoration in that building, which is Flakbate, the B-26 bomber, and a status on the challenges that they're going through right now to restore that for exhibition out on the floor. So there are a lot of interesting things about the things you don't think about when you're restoring an aircraft that you need to restore. Things like the jigs that they have the aircraft in its five pieces were all sort of rapidly built, and they're not the same height. So they're going to have to rebuild jigs so they can reassemble the fuselage.
And we'll have that interview coming up in, maybe next episode, if not next episode, pretty soon. David at the Restoration Center. So thanks for capturing that, David. It's a fascinating listen, and we'll have that in the not-too-distant future. But this episode, we have a listener recording. We'll start with that. This is from Dave, and Dave responded, as several others of you have, by sending us your memorable flights. So we have this recording. Dave recorded it, his memorable flight. And let's give it a listen.
Hi, Airplane Geeks. It's Dave Homewood here from New Zealand. You may have heard me on the Wings of New Zealand show. Recently, you've been getting listeners to send in their memorable flights. Well, I've got a couple. I can't remember any flights where I've had any problems. But memorable flights for me are the good ones. And I think two that stand out. One was way back in 1993. I was in the Royal New Zealand Air Force, and my ground trade involved painting aircraft. And we got the job of painting a Grumman Avenger, which had just arrived in the country. And it had come from Britain. It was X, Old Flying Machine Company, and it was wearing the colour scheme of George Bush, the then President of the United States, who had flown Avengers in the Pacific. And the new owner was Sir Tim Wallace of the Alpine Fighter Collection, and he wanted it put into Royal New Zealand Air Force colours. And we got the job of painting it up in RNZF colours as Plonky. And when it arrived on base, I was there. It was a weekend, and the pilot was none other than Mark Hanna, the very famous and late Mark Hanna. So I actually, that was the only time I ever got to briefly meet him. I just basically said hello, and he said hello to me. And that was pretty cool anyway. I was a big fan. We painted this aircraft, and over the few days that we rubbed it back and painted it up in the new colours, we were working with Alpine Fighter Collection guys, and my sergeant said to one of them that I was heading down to Wanaka where the aircraft was going. I was going down on the bus for the Easter break, which was coming up at the end of that week. And somehow between them, they arranged that I should throw away my bus ticket and go in the Avenger. Unbelievable. And so that's what I did on the morning of Good Friday, 1993. I climbed into the turret of the Grumman Avenger and took off, and we were joined by a P-40K, also owned by the collection, which was coming down with us as escort. The pilot in the P-40K was Tom Middleton, and here's me sitting in the turret looking out and watching Tom come up real close, nice and close formation, big smile on his face, looking at me, smiling back at him, and then he'd peel off and he'd go away and do some aerobatics, and then he'd come back up close again and just smile again, waiting for my reaction because I was watching all this. And I also remember we actually flew through a rainbow, which I didn't even know was possible. But on the way down country, which is, this is in the South Island of New Zealand, we flew through a rainbow and I saw all the colours come over the canopy. That was fantastic. So yeah, that flight was incredible. And at the end of it was just as good because we were at Wanaka, which was then the warbird capital of the Southern Hemisphere at that time. And for that weekend, they were opening the New Zealand Fighter Pilots Museum. And so Sir Tim Wallace had gathered together a whole lot of fighter aces. There was about 20 of them, and fighter pilots as well. But there was the big names were there. And they invited me along to the party they were having on the Saturday night, and I got to meet all these guys, and I remember standing at a table with Colin Gray, who was New Zealand's top ace, Des Scott, who was one of the top aces of the RNZF, and also the youngest group captain in the Royal Air Force during the war, and Bob Spurdle, who was a Battle of Britain pilot, and then came out to the Pacific, and so he flew in both arenas, them and their wives, and it was just such an entertaining evening. So that really capped it all off, and that was really the beginning of me really, really getting interested in the veterans who flew in the RNZF in World War II. I had actually read Bob Spurdle's and Colin Gray's books, and I had only like a week before bought Des Scott's book, and so you know I had a lot of things to talk to them about, and it was really great. So come full circle to the other flight, and this happened in March 2016, and now I do a lot of research, a lot of interviews with veterans and things like that, and I run the Wings Over New Zealand forum, and our forum gets together every now and then, and we have Wings Over New Zealand forum meets. So basically people off the internet can get together and actually meet each other and mix and mingle and socialize. And we always have some guest speakers that I arrange. And one of the guest speakers that I had teed up for this event that we're having at Ardmore was Doug Brooker. And he was going to talk to us about his Spitfire and about Spitfires in general. And that morning, just before we started the event, Doug came up to me and said, "What are you doing at 1 o'clock?" And I said, "Well, we've got this event, Doug." And he said, "Well, can you spare half an hour?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, sure. Why? I can, you know, I can rejig when the lunchtime is." And he said, "Because I've got a spare seat in the Spitfire, and I'm going to go and do a display. Would you like to come?" Well, honestly, I didn't know what to say other than yes. I walked out to the front of the crowd to open this event, and I was dumbstruck, and people were all looking at me wondering what was going on until I announced that I'd just been told I was going to have a ride in the Spitfire, and I got a rousing applause. And, yeah, it was amazing. When 1 o'clock rolled round, I was in the Spitfire with Doug, and we flew across Auckland, and then we did some beat-ups over the Museum of Transport and Technology and flew back again, and it was absolutely fantastic. This time I was able to film some of it, so I'll send you the clips of my my trip in the Spitfire, and you can all watch it and have the experience. And I will also send you a couple of photos that I took of Tom Middleton in the P-40K that was sitting outside the turret that I was in the Avenger. So those are my two most memorable flights. I've had a few other great ones as well, and a Thunder Mustang and a few things like that, but yeah, nothing will beat the Spitfire and the Avenger flights. Thanks.
Yeah, we have a photo of Dave in the Spitfire that's definitely going to make it into the show notes with a grin on his face that just says it all. And we'll also have these other videos that he mentioned. They're brief. They're nice and short. There's Spitfire startup. That's one video. There's taxiing out. There's takeoff. Spitfire over Auckland City and landing in the Spitfire. And we'll put all of those in the show notes as well. They've also sent us some other thoughts from his experiences. Maybe we'll put some of that text in there as well. And you can also find the link there to the Wings Over New Zealand show that he mentions, that he does. Dave's also very active in our Slack listener team, so you can find him there as well. So thanks, Dave, for sending that in. Very, very cool.
And are you surprised that in the photo there, it looks like he's grinning from ear to ear as he's sitting in the Spitfire?
I know. I love that picture. It just says it all. I mean, that's the experience. You can see it on his face.
Yeah, and this is not on the ground. This is in flight. So, yeah, he's right. Having a great time. It's interesting. The canopy looks like totally transparent. It looks like he's just sitting out there in space.
It does. It does. Very cool. All right. Now we've got something kind of a surprise that we haven't done in a while. If you're a new listener, you may not know that in the past we've had some contributors from different parts of the world send in reports and special segments and so forth, but we haven't had any of those in a while. But we do have one for you right now, and let's see if I can find this button that I haven't pushed in quite a long time.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, Avalon Air Show 2017. We're back, babies.
Hey, well, good day, folks, and welcome back to... What was this segment called anyway, McHaren?
Oh, something about a desk in Australia. Oh, the Australia desk!
The Australia desk! Yeah, oh, I told you we'd be back at some point.
Oh, mate, yeah, we know. Hey, don't push that button.
God, well, it is the Australian International Air Show, so here we are. And, Grant, we've been doing a little bit of work for PCDU and a little bit of work of our own. What have you been up to, mate?
Oh, I've been doing a hell of a lot of work for my day job and doing presentations to senior Air Force types and also...
Very interesting. I've been working for the aircraft. I've been working for the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, and I've got the executive director here, Ben Morgan. How are you, Ben?
G'day, guys. How are you?
That was not a nice segue, wasn't
not
it?
Bad. Last time we all three of us were here together recording, it was at Tamora, and we were all doing some sort of
something
show.
Like that. So the days of old when knights were bold, yeah. And castles are made from stone and gold.
That's you've rehearsed that one once or twice, haven't you?
Hey, Ben, AOPA Australia, we're having a big relaunch, aren't we? We're trying to do what the Americans do, and this is going into an American podcast.
Well, we're not just doing what the Americans are doing. We're doing it much, much better.
Absolutely.
And it's incredibly exciting to be back here at Avalon, flying the AOPA flag and getting out and meeting all of our members and all of our supporters out there.
One of the things we're going to be doing is pushing a lot more into digital media, and we're looking at what the American groups do and how well they advocate for GA, and that's really a renewed focus, isn't it?
Absolutely, and I really have to say that the PCDU boys really pioneered a lot of this over the last 7 years, and I'm really pleased to be able to partner up with you, Steve, and I think that we've got some pretty exciting days ahead, because digital media, of course, is just incredible. It gets out to so many people. It can be right in your phone. It can be right on your iPad. It can be right on your desktop.
Always
by the
right
way,
in your face.
It's out there.
Right. And right in your podcast. So what have you been doing this week? You've been running a seminar. We had a conference yesterday.
Absolutely. Look, we've had just such a busy schedule for Avalon 17. We've had all kinds of events running within the village section itself. Oz Runways, Garmin, the top brands all here talking the latest and greatest of their technology and showing people how to get hands-on. And, of course, AOPA themselves, with our directors out and about meeting people and talking to them about the issues that seem to be at the foremost of everybody's mind. Class 2 medical, of course.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And all the other regulation reforms that we need to see our industry kickstart and go back into full revival.
What's really been good too is we've had the head of AOPA New Zealand here as well, and you've been having talks with them as well about maybe how we can do things and work together from this part of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the hallmarks of Avalon 17 is the fact that internationally we've been able to bring some of our partner organisations in from overseas, and Ian is just a fabulous president over in New Zealand, has been able to work closely with the New Zealand government to achieve a great deal. So there's a great deal that's to be learned from Ian. I'm very lucky to have shared a huge chunk of his time for this period, and I'll be looking forward to seeing many of his programs integrated here to Australia as well.
Now, if you're an Australian pilot and you're listening to this podcast, now we know you're out there. There's plenty of them out there, isn't there, Grant? Listen to Airplane Geeks. Okay, so if you're not a member, you should join. If you've been a member and you've let it lapse like I had, rejoin. It's about $160 a year, good value.
Yeah, look, let's not talk value. Let's talk about what the $160 does. The $160 really provides the horsepower and the financial resource for this organisation to get out and advocate strongly. And more than just advocacy, we're out in the community now at the grassroots looking at all kinds of youth programs. We've got some exciting offerings which we'll be launching in the next couple of months as we head towards our May AGM, with aircraft being made available for members to be able to get out there and get kids flying. Possibly, there could be, who knows, maybe an aircraft giveaway or two.
Nah, come on, man. What, the model? Yeah, the model.
No, not models. We're looking at giving away a fully refurbished general aviation aeroplane. This is not going to be a one-off. This is going to be a hallmark of the association. We're going to be doing this year after year. Never has there been a better time to get back to AOPA and start enjoying the freedom of flight that our membership affords.
And even you don't even have to be a pilot. I was a member for ages, and all I was just enthusiastic.
All right, all you Aussie pilots are there, aopa.com.au. Now, Grant, some of the other things we've been looking at here, of course, you know, the Americans brought their F-22 here, of course, but that got trumped. The first two Aussie F-35s arrived today to much pomp and ceremony.
Yeah, they certainly did, mate. They came in and just put on the power and went nice and fast past, and you know, actually the first pass everyone was like, oh, they're a bit quiet, we all thought they were going to be noisy, and then they came back like they were going to land, and did a missed approach, and one just put on the coals and went straight upwards, and the other one did a big tight turn after, and everyone's like, oh, there's the noise, and yeah, one engine, and it was as loud if not louder than an F-22.
Yeah,
and that's not even the B model.
Yeah, so we did the media call today. It was all pomp and ceremony. The Defence Minister was here and the Prime Minister was here doing all those sort of, you know, politician stuff. That was really interesting. But looking at those jets, we put some, if you're on Facebook, have a look at the PCDU page. That photographer, I think that was me, that photographer.
Oh, I think it was. I think I took a couple of photos, but I came out, I was doing all sorts of interviews and business development meetings this morning. So I had my operations manager with me, and so yeah, we came out, and as I'm walking into the media blister to take where you guys were taking photos, all of a sudden this hand just goes on my shoulder, and it's one of our clients, a squadron leader, and he's like, "What are you doing on that side of the line?" Wait a minute, we're having a blast.
Now, of course, these two airframes, AU1 and AU2, or as we know them better here, A35-001 and 002. For I know there's a lot of serial number of people here. So these airframes, of course, have been at I think Luke Air Force Base
over in Arizona.
So they've island hopped their way over here and had plenty of tanker stops in between all of those islands, and they'll only be here for a week or so. They did fly in the other day to RAAF Base Amberley up there in Queensland, and I think they'll be staging back from there. They've got to go back into the training pool.
That's right, mate. They've got to go back to Luke Air Force Base to join the training pool. So what happens is, if you're training pilots in that training pool, each country supplies X number of airframes into the pool based on their number of pilots. So that's how that system works. So Australia has two airframes in there. They've been released for this special momentous occasion for us down here, and they're going back to return to the pool. And of course, these are early models, so if they do actually wind up coming back to Australia to be included in the mainstream of the full 74 or 72 aircraft we're getting, they're going to have some major upgrades to bring them online with all the other ones. But that's part and parcel of what's going on.
Probably the most funny thing I saw today was the two test pilots, Jacko and Bellier. You know, those guys have kind of become unwilling superstars, I think, in the aviation community.
Yeah.
I think Bellier, he kind of looks quite at ease with it. We saw Jacko a bit later on having a chat in the halls. I said, "You look really comfortable there, not."
Yeah, he was like, "Yeah, bugger off."
Yeah. Yeah, no, and some of the questions the mainstream were throwing at them had nothing to do with aircraft and all that. And, yeah, it was almost cringeworthy yet again. But, hey, you know, the big thing is we're surrounded by Avalon. This is my last day. I've done Tuesday through Friday. I got stuff I got to do this weekend. And most of my... Yeah, I'm now in the business, so most of the people I've had to see and do stuff with have all gone. Yep. I've caught up with a whole lot of people. I believe you're staying for longer, though.
Yeah, I'll be here probably at least tomorrow, Saturday, and maybe Sunday. We'll see how it goes. But, yeah, you certainly are living the dream, mate, working for a defence contractor and you're putting more miles on Virgin aircraft these days than most Virgin Australia pilots, I must say.
Yeah, I'm now platinum. Yay. Now I've just got to try and maintain that somehow.
Well, hey, mate, we better sign off because there's about to be a Royal Australian Air Force C-17 Globemaster. We haven't heard any Globemaster bloopers, have we?
No, no Globemasters, but it's a noise master now. Hey!
Well, that's everything we have for you on this year's Australian Air.
Yes, if you're lucky, we'll be back before the end of the air, but don't count on it.
Okay, we got to watch this aircraft. I'm Steve Fisher.
I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, everybody. No, Grant, that really does remind me of that time I rode on that Hercules.
Come on. I've had a Spartan ride, and I've been in four of the King Airs.
I'm never speaking to you again.
Yeah. You just had a tanker. Remember, there's only one little difference between tanker and...
Oh, God.
All right, that's wonderful. Steve sent some photos of the F-35 that was down there, one of the two that was down in... Australia, and I tell you what, David, Steve's pictures look better than the pictures I saw in the media. He's doing pretty well. Also, Steve has been involved in the production of a number of little video interviews with AOPA, and we've got some of those. We'll put those in the show notes as well. But boy, you know, it sure felt like old times again listening to the Oz Desk.
I forgot how fast they talk.
You know, I wish they wouldn't take themselves so seriously. I wish they'd, you know, loosen up, have a little more fun. You know, that's the thing that really bothers me. No, they sound like they're having an awesome time.
Well, when you have one air show every 2 years, unlike the rest of the world, you have to suck it up for.
All right. Well, you can find those guys, of course, at the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, which is at planecrazydownunder.com. All right. Just one quick item. We received from Kevin. Actually, Kevin sent this in and Neil did as well. A4A, Airlines for America, that's a group of most of the major U.S. airlines. They have a new survey out, Status of Air Travel in the United States. And we'll put a link to this in the show notes. It's really kind of interesting to look at. Now, it's a brand new survey conducted January 2017, released on February 28th. There are, really a number of really interesting charts. We don't have time this episode to go through all of these, but maybe just a couple. I thought it was fascinating. If you look at the percentage of the population that's traveled by air from 1971 through current, and it is really a consistently rising percentage to the point now where 89% of the American population has traveled by an airline at some time in their lifetime, but 89%. 49% of Americans have traveled by airline in 2016. Those are really high numbers. But there are some other interesting charts in there, how many trips people have taken on average, the fact that personal, in the last 2 years, in 2015 and 16, personal air travel by airline has increased a lot over business air travel. It tells by trips by race and ethnicity.
Ethnicity.
Usually it's us trying to fix David's pronunciation. Okay. What David said, also trips by age. Yeah, role reversal here. Satisfaction. Now, this is kind of confusing. Well, confusing. This is kind of surprising. Satisfaction with, quote, overall experience with air travel in 2016, 43% are very satisfied with their overall air travel experience in 2016. That's compared to 35% in 2015, so that's way up. Somewhat satisfied is close. It's about a tie, but it's around 44% somewhat satisfied. So almost everyone is either very satisfied or somewhat satisfied. Neutral in 2016 was 10%, somewhat dissatisfied, 5%, very dissatisfied, 1%. These are really good numbers, I think. I don't know. Were you guys surprised at that level of satisfaction for people with commercial air travel?
Well, if 49% of the population are flying and they're only flying once a year and they arrive safely,
they're satisfied.
You can understand. Well, they're satisfied. I mean, it's the people like Rob and Brian who aren't here to defend themselves who tend to complain the most because they do more flying than everybody else. So the potential of their satisfaction goes down because there's more of a potential of them flying United and then getting screwed up.
Oh, gosh.
So I kind of agree with
that. Right. Yeah, well, I guess I can see that.
Yeah, I agree, too. I think back of all my trips in 2016, nothing went wrong. Showed up, luggage showed up, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, and I was also commenting the other day that TSA lines seem to have gotten better in the last few years. I mean, that was just a huge issue. Went back a few years, and boy, I didn't run into any lines that caused me any concern this past year. But I agree, that very first chart that you mentioned, that was the one that caught my attention, too. If you go back to 1971, only 49% of the U.S. Population, adult population, had ever flown in an airliner before. And you can see where the graph kind of bumps up around 78 or so. And that's, of course, when deregulation occurred, back when the Civil Aeronautics Board was wiped off the face of the earth. And people may not recall, but back in those days, the CAB had to approve every single airline fare, every single route that was flown here in the United States. And it's just hard to believe that that was ever the case. And of course, now, you know, things change on an hourly basis in terms of, you know, fares and routes and all that kind of stuff. And I think the industry has profited from that.
All right. Well, I think we need to wrap this one up. I want to thank all of you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. And we really want to thank our guest, Jonathan Barron, JB, Shark Aero's U.S. representative and importer. You find them at sharkaero.com. Really nice looking airplane. I really like this airplane. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. The website has links to where you can find us on social media, how to contact us, how you can subscribe, and all that. You can go straight to the show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/442. All right, Max Trescott, tell everybody where we can find you online.
Well, for all of our pilots out there, if any of you are looking to get smarter about the Garmin G1000, you can find my books on that subject at g1000book.com. And if you just want to follow my whimsical little tweets that occur from time to time, and actually most of them are kind of aviation news related, go out and follow me at Twitter, Max Trescott.
Okay. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
Well, hopefully you'll find me more often on this show. You can find me on Friday mornings on the UAV Digest with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones. You can find me on Twitter. If you can spell Vanderhoof, that would be DM Vanderhoof. And also you can check out my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
Great. On Twitter, I'm Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby at paxxpodcast.com. Our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find him, of course, at brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
So are we going with Jonathan, John, or JB?
I think I'll go with JB because that's the most unique out of all of them.
Okay.
Well, okay, let's rephrase this. What was the call sign in the Navy? We could always go by that, too.
It was actually JB. So
That's not very creative.
I know. And it's super lame. It was.
Were you like really boring in the Navy or something?
I was going to say that must be it. You didn't screw up.
Well, that's part of the call sign joke, right? So, At my first squadron, there were five of us. There were Jonathans, right? And of the five of us, three of us were Jonathan B something. That's Jonathan Barron, Jonathan Burns, and. Our CO got tired of confusing all of us. He just said, okay, line up on the wall. And they said, okay, you're John Alpha, you're John Bravo, you're John Charlie. I just happen to be the dude in the middle.
Lucky you.
I know it's pretty lame, but yeah, I guess.
But that's a good story. That's a good story for a lame call sign. That's a good story.
It is a good story.
Yeah. It's better than a call sign like screw up or something like that, right? I mean, that's good.
Well, there's definitely like opportunity for that. It just never stuck. Yeah, just a plug for you guys. Thanks for what you're doing, because I started listening to you guys when I was deploying to Afghanistan.
Oh, really?
And what I would do is, I would hoard all my airplane geeks for the long trips out, right? And so I would have this CD full of it, and I would, you know, it took a lot of effort to kind of collect all of it, because when you get out there, you wouldn't have any. But
yeah.
You know, I appreciate the work that you guys do, because it's pretty awesome.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. Thank you very much.
Wow. That's a great story.
Yeah. Cool.
Dateline, Avalon, 2017. We're back, babies.
Hey, we are. What are we doing? How do we do this?
I don't know. Which button do we... Oh, bugger off.
Who is that?
Some bloody Yank.
Who let those guys in here?
I don't know. He's been here all week.
He's been here all week. Well, of course, that's one of three F-22 Raptors that's here at Avalon, the Australian International Air Show 2017.
Well, I think we're going to have to give this one up. I'll call this one a blooper. We'll try this again after this numbnuts has gone to put his plane away.
Oh, we need to rehearse three more times before we do this anyway.
Oh, there is always that.
Situation normal.
Good to be back.